Role models are very important. In fact, a study that was just recently done that came out in the news was they found out, according to these two sociologists who looked at data from a large national survey called the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, which includes a lot of behavior, information on behavior, sexual behavior for 19,000 13 to 18-year-olds. What these sociologists discovered in tabulating all this data was they essentially looked at some interesting figures, and they found, as surprising as this correlation is, they found that teenagers whose parents smoked were about 50% more likely to have had sex by the time they were 15. What? Correlation between having sex and smoking? And they basically found that adolescents whose parents engage in any risky behavior, especially smoking, are especially likely to be sexually active. Now, the point of this is that parents are an important role model. And more than just what you tell your kids, they watch your life. They watch your discipline, your habits. They know that smoking is unhealthy. So they see you do it and they wonder, well, why are you doing that? And it's one of those things where, according to these sociologists, that the survey found that no matter if there was close supervision of teens, it was overrun by the risky behavior. That had a greater impact on them. If parents smoked or drank, the influence of the behavior outweighed the benefits of supervision. In fact, this was interesting. Wilder and Watt found that boys were more likely to have sex if their parents failed to use seatbelts. Now, interesting. But it just shows you how closely our example, what we model for our kids in obeying the law and following rules and watching our own health, how closely kids are absolutely watching us. Now, in looking at this, we come to the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon had a lot of wise sayings when it came to the Proverbs. We saw a lot of things that really are pithy and apply to life. But now we look at Solomon in a way that we haven't seen him before. In many respects, we're looking at his testimony here in this book. We're looking at a man who now is old, who didn't follow his own advice, didn't practice what he preached. And now he is appealing from a new level of one who has experienced the hard way, and he's trying to instruct young people, there is another side to this. Don't make the same mistakes that I made. Now, we say that to our kids a lot, don't we? And unfortunately, many times, again, they just follow us with what we're doing right now. But this is where this comes in. Now, he opens by saying the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. We know that's Solomon because there are other identifications of him. He doesn't say his name plainly, but it's a very easy one to figure out. But he uses the term preacher. In fact, that's where we get the title of this book from. It's the Hebrew word, which is translated preacher here, in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation, it's translated assembly. It's the same word for assembly, and we get the word, the Greek word ekklesia, which we get the word church. That's where the word church comes from. So the word gets, the title comes to Ecclesiastes. Kind of a strange convolution there of how this title came to be. But I have to ask you a question about this. What do you think of when you think of the term preacher? I don't know about you, but to me that has a negative connotation. I think of someone preachy. I think of being preached at. I think of someone that may or may not have a good example, but he's just going to tell you what's there. And you kind of feel a little bit icky under that scrutiny from someone that knows all the right answers, but may or may not be living it. However, the word preacher is not a good full expression of this. He's actually appealing to one in that word assembly, which means to, by influence, draw others to him. Solomon is appealing. He's saying, listen to the words of the one who has wisdom to draw others in. Certainly, that was Solomon's life. People came from all over the world to hear him because of the wisdom the Lord had given him. But his statement in this next verse is quite startling. He says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. We could say that in a way, empty of emptiness. Emptiness of emptiness, all is empty, meaningless, futile. Sort of an odd conclusion, wouldn't you say? Why would someone say that? Why would someone express this way? Well, when he goes on, you learn there is a secret, because this phrase, vanity of vanities, repeated often, 25 times in Ecclesiastes. It's also accompanied by another very familiar phrase when he says, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? That's the other phrase, under the sun. And now you can make some correlation here. Solomon was wise. He had been given incredible wisdom. Remember the night when the Lord appeared to him in Gibeon in 1 Kings chapter 3, for those of you who are taking notes. God spoke to him and said, ask what I shall give to you, whatever you want, Solomon. Blank check. Go ahead and write whatever you want. Solomon says, I'm a little child. I don't know how to go in and among your people. You've called me to lead these great people of yours, and I don't even know what I'm doing. Please give me great understanding to judge your people that I might discern good and evil. The Bible says that God was pleased with that request because he didn't ask for great wealth or victory over his enemies. He says, I'm not only going to give you wisdom such as no man has ever had, but I'm going to give you all the other things as well. And the Bible records in 1 Kings 4 that God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand and the seashore. His wisdom excelled all the men of the East and the men of Egypt. Now, the Egyptians were like the Americans are today. You know, they were the peak of technology. They were the epitome of, you know, power and understanding and wisdom and intellect and study, universities. Solomon had more than all of them. He spoke 3,000 proverbs. He spoke of things from nature, science, all kinds of things. And the Bible says that all men from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And now here you find this incredibly wise man in this volume, say vanity of vanities, all is vanity, emptiness, futile, worthless, everything. But the key word, the key phrase, under the sun. Keep in mind that Solomon's volume here is going to teach us something, that one who's departed from the Lord, that now can only see that which is in this materialistic world, it's all empty. If you just take into consideration that which is under the sun, life is meaningless. See, without God, life has no meaning. Only what you may be arbitrarily ascribed to it, that you might say, well, if I'm going to live this way. I think it's good to do this and good to do that. But you're just arbitrarily making decisions without really having a basis for them. So Solomon is now going to give his testimony. He became very foolish because he disobeyed God. He said not to multiply gold, not to worry about riches. He multiplied gold to himself. In fact, the Bible records that his yearly income just of gold was, get this number, 666. Does that ring a bell? 666 talents of gold a year. Now, a talent would be a measurement that someone could deadlift. And depending on how strong you are, it would be from anywhere from 120 pounds to maybe 250, 300 pounds. That's a lot of gold. You measure out the ounces times $400 an ounce approximately, you've got a lot of money coming in. And that's just the gold. Those who studied closely all that he described that he got in a year figured his annual income, when you consider, if you compared it in our economy today, it'd be equivalent to $2 to $3 billion a year. That's his salary. Now, you can't even spend that much money. I mean, that's more money than you can even imagine. But understand this. He says all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he labors under the sun? Solomon, in all of his disobedience, you see, he lost perspective with God. He lost sight of eternity. And now he's measuring life as everything under the sun. And because of this, we have an interesting discourse into his experiments of life and his conclusions. This is very helpful because, you know, there are a lot of people in this same category. That they're trying to find meaning and purpose in life. They're trying to find and discover, you know, why am I here? What is the purpose? And there is that vacuum there. And of course, this picture of vanity is its reference to all that is under the sun. Solomon shows the futility in the attempt to find meaning under the sun without taking into account And this is the key, eternity. See, without eternity, what's the point? If there is no life beyond this life, then life is meaningless, purposeless, and futile. So he goes on to speak about this prophet. What profit is there? If there's no afterlife, what's the point? Why be good if there is no afterlife? Doesn't make any sense. He goes on to say, one generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. Now here's the trick in our lives. This is the real clincher that really grates at us. See, we get old and we die just about the time we figure out what life's all about. We're ready to die. Youth is wasted on the youth. You've heard that one. It's true. You know, your body is young and strong when you're young, but you don't know anything. You think you know everything, but you don't know anything. And then, about the time you figure things out, your body don't work anymore. In the Old Testament, it speaks about man's ways. The days of man are like grass. As the flower of the field, he flourishes, and the wind passes over it, it's no more. Psalm 103 describes this temporariness of man and the futility of that. And especially so when you consider back in the antediluvian age, that is before the flood, the lifespan was much, much longer. Now, it was longer most probably because of the atmospheric conditions were so different. You know, today, harmful cosmic rays are believed to be the reason why we age to begin with. See, if you had no outside effect, if your cells, which reproduce themselves, and your body replenishes itself every 7 years, if it did so perfectly, you could live forever. You know, death is kind of the oddity. You should be able to replace your cells all the time, but the problem is every time your cells replicate, they're just slightly changed. It would be like making a copy of a cassette tape over and over and over again, a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. By the time you get down to the end, it's going to be like, you can't hardly hear it. All the noise that comes in. Well, essentially, that's exactly what happens in your cells when they replicate. Just a little bit of noise enters in, a little bit of mutation from the harmful rays, and your body ages. It doesn't replicate itself perfectly. Before the flood, there was a canopy of water. Apparently, the waters above the firmament, the atmospheric conditions were much more pressurized. You had tropical vegetation worldwide. You have evidence of this in the woolly mammoths that they dig out of Antarctica, and they find there's tropical vegetation frozen in their intestines. You know, they were frozen immediately from a tropical environment. They were quick frozen. Something happened to drastically change everything suddenly. And it's believed that this canopy of water fell, it condensed, the pressure just released. Anytime when you have pressure releasing, you have the temperature drop immensely. It's a fantastic look at what took place. But it explains why dinosaurs could live, which are really essentially reptiles, and reptiles continue to grow, and they could get big and huge over the long span of years. And everything was different, and especially man. He lived 700 years, 800 years. Methuselah, the oldest man, 969 years. Now imagine living that long. That would be quite different, wouldn't it? Imagine this. Imagine being able to have a photographic memory and to live that long. You would essentially know just about every science and about every art. You would know just about everything in your day. Imagine the descendants you'd have. You'd have hundreds and hundreds of children. Because the childbearing years would be a long period of time. Ladies, you'd be pregnant hundreds of times. Wouldn't that be fun? But think of the children you'd have. You'd have hundreds of children, essentially, then their children, and you'd be able to enjoy your, not just your grandchildren, but your great, 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 great grandchildren. Imagine what that would be like. That's why when you're reading in the Old Testament and you see these guys went out and started a city, they did. They got married, started a city, because eventually it was all their family. Life would be quite different. Here we live in our limited age now, 70 on average. So quick, so brief. It's a cheat. You know, you still feel young. You know, I get out on the basketball court and my mind says I can do it. My body says, uh-uh. It's just not fair. But this is the limitation we have, and this is the futility. Now, if everything that was real was just that which is under the sun, if there were no eternity, if there were nothing beyond this life, then we would have to agree wholeheartedly with Solomon as he says, emptiness of emptiness. One generation passes, another one comes, and it's not fair because the earth abides forever. Look at the systems. He says the sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. It's constant. It never ends. It's a constant thing. It abides. Now, critics of the Bible have picked on some of these phrases, the sun rising and the sun setting, and sounded so sanctimonious in their expressions of criticism, saying, well, you see, these Bible people, they just didn't know back then that the sun really doesn't rise and set, but the earth rotates and it appears that the sun rises and sets. And so they really didn't understand that back then. You know, there is this propaganda that we are so fed in our public school systems and in life general in the media that when the farther you go back in time, the more primitive people were. You know, cave dwellers, Neanderthal type people. You know, that is such propaganda. Solomon was brilliant. They knew that the sun didn't rise or set. They knew that the world was round in those days. Job, the oldest book in the Bible, speaks about the earth hanging on nothing. Other science at the time may have been uninformed, and maybe that seemed to be the general thought. But God's people knew, and generally the ancients knew. They had tremendous abilities, though they didn't have the technology we have today. Their technology was smarter. It wasn't dependent upon fossil fuels and giving us the vulnerability to the Middle Eastern countries. You know, I mean, a total different world. But they could accomplish just as much. They could build the pyramids. We, with our technology, can't figure out how they did that to such precision. Even with our technology, we'd have a hard time to do exactly what they did with the alignment of the channels to the stars and the type of a calendar. It was a fascinating thing. These ancients were brilliant. Now, come on, Pastor. What about all the pictures in the caves of people? You know, people did live in caves back then. Well, you know, the Bible even tells you in Job. Job spoke about the degenerates who lived in the caves. So there were people that were backward from society that chose to live out in the caves, but people were educated. They knew that wasn't the main life. And because we find some pictures in caves, we assume everybody was that way. Propaganda. Now, I'm getting off my point here because the point really is this. Solomon expresses wisdom in these systems. The sun rising, by the way, even our modern meteorologists use the same terminology. When you listen to the news tonight, you watch to see what time they'll tell you the sun rises and the sun sets. Well, the wind goes toward the south and turns toward the north, and the wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. So he recognized the wind currents. He also, notice in verse 7, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. What is he describing? He's describing modern hydrology, which really wasn't quantified until much later. They didn't really understand this concept. But the rivers are running into the seas, yet the sea's not full. Why doesn't the sea overflow? Because you have this cycle. The sea, three-quarters of the earth, is covered with water, which is just the right amount for the evaporation process to provide the clouds to water the land. And yet, if it were more water percentage, we'd have flooding. If it were less water, the world would be like a desert. So it's the perfect balance. But he notices this water cycle. But again, that's not the point. The point is this. All things are full of labor. Man can't express it. Everything's happening in immense ways. This world and the sun and the systems that are around, they constantly are continuing in all this labor. Yet here's the trick. Here's the sadness. The eye is not satisfied with seeing or the ear filled with hearing. There's a futility there. The Bible speaks about God created us with a little spark of that futility. Pascal, the philosopher, put it in another way. He said, in the heart of every man is a God-shaped vacuum. Only God can fill it. Solomon, with all of his wisdom and brilliance and scientific understanding that attracted everyone in the whole world, he's basically saying all is vanity because his wisdom has now been cut off from above because of his backslidden state. From his perspective, under the sun, that phrase he keeps using, all things are empty. That which has been will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new, remember the phrase, under the sun. In other words, it just keeps going. Everything just keeps revolving, repeating. Everything's going on. And even so in human nature. Human nature has not largely changed over the years. You know, in fact, it doesn't matter where you are in the world. People are basically the same. Long before I went to Africa, I knew what the people in Africa were like. They were greedy and lustful. Long before I went to Europe, I knew what people in Europe were like. Greedy and lustful. Then going to the Middle East, greedy and lustful. Here in America, that's how I know that they're the same everywhere, because here in America, they're greedy and lustful. It's human nature. And it largely has not changed. The needs of the people are basically the same. And the point is, there was no greater satisfaction then than there is now, or now than there is then. And he even later says, it's not of wisdom that you say the good old days. The problem is because you really don't really remember. We can't even remember in our short lifespan, let alone what was it like in former times. He says, is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new, it has already been in ancient times before us. It's already been. There's nothing new. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. You know, we definitely have amnesia. And the problem is, even those aspects of history that we think we have are suspect. Because who wrote the history? Those in power. You know, right before your very eyes, history is being rewritten. And our textbooks in our school that we're teaching our children has been so carefully edited out of any religious example. The founding fathers' statements of God and prayer are largely omitted because the people in charge of this right now have a bias against religion and God and Christianity and want to remove any types of expressions of that so they can essentially rewrite history, which is what is happening. Even in a short span of time, even since September 11, 2001, when the World Trade Center was hit, it has been largely twisted. A powerful lobby, the National Education Association, has advised teachers to not place any blame for those attacks and to try to teach kids that we really, as Americans, are responsible for this happening to us. And I mean, some of the nonsense that's being expressed because people have a particular thing they want to say. So it's a hard thing to remember, even in a short time ago, what the point is, let alone imagine with no firsthand knowledge, thousands of years ago, what was it really like? The archaeologist Spade has uncovered a number of things that we can piece together, but imagine discovering a garbage dump 2,000 years from now and trying to piece together what society was like. First of all, most of the stuff would be deteriorated and only certain things would be left. And you'd have to piece things together. What would they know about us by looking through our garbage 2,000 years from now? Point is, it's hard to understand. Even first-hand knowledge, what's the oldest person alive right now is 115. I think the guy that was 116 just died. Now the oldest is 115. What is that in comparison to thousands of years? Centuries? The point is, under the sun, there's nothing new. It's hard to discern. You can't even remember when it is anyway. And I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. It's a little cynical, can you tell? This wisdom has become a burden, a labor. Well, he took his eyes off of God, and it would naturally be a burden just considering what's under the sun. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. That which is the real problem, Solomon has discerned and figured out that it cannot be changed. That crookedness can't make it straight. What is lacking can't be numbered. You can't add to it. Now, he was a student not just of science and nature. He was also a student of personality and people. He understood what was in man. Proverbs, of course, reveal that he had tremendous insight into human nature. But essentially what he says here, what is crooked cannot be made straight, that's considering no eternity, you understand. Again, remember his outlook is that which is just under the sun. This would be equivalent to us saying, hey, once a child molester, always a child molester. He's not going to change. And most people have that. Now, I believe that God's grace could change, but it's very rare, because oftentimes people that go to that level of sin don't have an openness to the grace of God. And I look at this and I think, just looking at human nature, just looking at this world under the sun, it can't be changed. He says, I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who are before me in Jerusalem. That's how we know this is Solomon. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. You know, it would be a very depressing thing to spend your entire life studying things, hoping for something new, something different, something exciting, only to find out nothing is new under the sun. It's all the same. But there's something in us that wants that new thing. You know, why do you think Madison Avenue uses in their techniques of advertising, they always throw in the new and improve? Why? That appeals. We want something new. We don't want something old. That's old. That's not good. New is better. We want something new. But under the sun, nothing new. Nothing new. The good news is that the Bible says that God's mercies are new every morning. The very answer to that aching in our heart for something real, something substantive, something I could sink my teeth into, something that's new and fresh, can't be found under the sun. But it can be found in the Son of God. It can be found in God's purpose. See, all that he had, for he at his conclusion in verse 18 in this chapter, for in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. You know, to me, the cause of the drug and alcohol epidemic in this land are largely because we need purpose beyond that which is just from a materialistic standpoint. We're going to find that not just wisdom caused him grief, but seeking after pleasure and mirth, seeking after things in this world, trying to fill himself with all kinds of experiences, nothing is going to meet the need, because it does not give the real answer, purpose. Just as your body needs food in order to sustain itself, to create the energy in order to live, your mind needs something. And if your mind does not get this something, it's going to try anything it can to ameliorate, to lessen the pain of not getting that something. And that something is purpose. You cannot live without purpose, meaning. Why are you here? What is your purpose in life? What were you born for? Where will you end up? What is your purpose? Without understanding that, your mind short circuits. It frustrates itself. It ends up just like Solomon here. It's grief. It's sorrow. It's emptiness. It's futility. And there is no difference between wisdom and madness and folly. It doesn't even make any sense anymore. Kind of like you become like Nietzsche, who his whole goal in life was to become mad, and he succeeded because he saw no purpose in his intellect, in his knowledge, and madness was equal to him because there was no purpose. Your mind needs purpose. And you know, when you don't get it, you've got to lessen the pain. So people crave something to fill that void, or to anesthetize themselves with drugs and alcohol, to forget about themselves, to forget about their problems, forget about the fact they have no real meaning in life. Let's just go from one party to another and not think about it. This is where Solomon is here. The Bible tells us that there is meaning and purpose, but it's not found under the sun. It's only found in the sun. God sent his only son into this world to die in our place so that we could have fellowship with him. Now, he needed to die in order for us to have fellowship. The reason is because God is holy. He created us perfectly. But he gave us the fatal flaw. That fatal flaw was not really a flaw in its sense, but it was to allow for something to happen that was quite unique among people, opposed to the animals. He gave us a self-determinant being. He made us a self-determinant being, and he gave us that amazing thing called choice. If he did not give us choice, we would be just on the level of one of those little dolls. You pull the string and it says, I love you, mommy. I love you, mommy. I love you, God. I love you, God. That's what we would be if he did not give us choice. But by giving us choice, you have the risk of people choosing something else. And Adam and Eve chose to disobey. And as our federal head, they represented the entire human race. And though they were made in the image of God, we were born in Adam and Eve's image after sin had affected them. And sin blasted the entire human race. And we're bent towards self. We're bent toward a rebellion against God. We don't want to yield to God. So we will try everything else and try everything else. And Solomon does that until you finally realize it's not working. Because God created us for himself. Only he can satisfy us. So people try to fill themselves with anything else to keep from coming back to the one who made them and the one who created them in his image. And for his purpose, he made us a living soul. And to hide that eternity in our hearts that only he can satisfy with his mercies, which are new every morning. You know, one day we will stand before him. See, the Bible speaks about the resurrection. It speaks about the afterlife. Daniel spoke way back when he says that at the end, people will rise to everlasting shame and contempt, and others will rise to everlasting life. But ultimately, all are going to rise from the grave. This physical dimension, this physical life is not all there is. There's more. This is not all there is. But depending on what you believe and where you put your heart will be the outcome of that eternity. That's why Jesus said, what does it gain you if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? You've gained for this little piece of time pleasures and excitement. And even then, a lot of sorrow mixed in. You've sacrificed all of eternity for this little moment. It doesn't make sense. You know, he said, lay up treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust corrupt. That's the best investment strategy you could ever get. Because you'll never lose that. It's an annuity that won't stop. And yet we don't understand that, and we've got to see from Solomon's example. Now, a wise person learns from someone else's example. A foolish person has to learn the hard way. It's the most expensive lesson when you have to learn it the hard way. That's why Benjamin Franklin said experience is a dear teacher. Not dear in the sense of good, but expensive. You can't afford to pay the price by learning the hard way every time. Learn from someone else's example. Learn from what the Bible says. Solomon was a great one to teach us because he had it all. And he says, under the sun, it's empty. And when you come to that conclusion, you realize there's something beyond just under the sun. That God created us for a greater purpose. So I'm anticipating, as we go through this book, a real hearty look into Solomon's experimentation. We can see what he discovered. We can put the pieces together and consider all these things. And it's a great book. Perhaps people that you know, co-workers of yours, friends that you have, acquaintances, family members, that may not even consider coming to a church because they have a preconceived idea of what a church might be and what you do there at a church and maybe the pressures and the feeling of, you know, all the things that you bring, the baggage that people have. Maybe you can pray about talking with them and inviting them out and say, hey, we're looking at a very interesting study. I think that you might find interesting. Give them an opportunity to maybe check this out, because I think there's something here in Solomon that can relate with every person on some level or another. Pray about others around that you see maybe looking for answers, wanting to know what it is you found. And just say, hey, come and see. Come check it out. See what happens. But maybe you're here today already with the thought in your mind, where am I standing? Where do I sit with all this? Are you feeling like you're on the outside looking in? You're seeing kind of a community of people here that have a joy and a sense of peace and they understand some things and no, not perfect, because it all depends on a person's level of understanding of God and comprehension of him, that their life is going to be transformed. But when you see that example, it strikes a hunger in your own heart. You know, I want that. That's what happened to me when I saw that one guy on the wrestling team at Michigan State pray for his meal. Something just clicked. And I thought, you know what? He seems to be so peaceful. So I grabbed him in the wrestling room the next day and says, hey, I noticed you prayed for your meal. And he goes, yeah, I'm a Christian. I go, oh, yeah, yeah, I know all about that stuff. I didn't want to have some sermon preached at me at that point. But, you know, there was something about his life and his peace. It was attractive. It hit something in my heart that I didn't have. And God used that man to get my attention. And I remember calling out to God myself that day. Jesus, if you're there, come into my life. And maybe that's where you are right now. You felt that futility. You feel like you've tried things in the world. And even when you get ahead, you don't really get ahead. Some of the greatest curses in our lives can be when we get everything we want. And we find out it didn't help. Something's missing. And we live in a very affluent area. You know, you drive down these streets, people have all kinds of things. You probably have your fill of things for many of you here. But it doesn't answer the real heartfelt need. Because only God can. He made you. And He's not going to make you into some religious weirdo. You know, the caricatures of religious people in the media are quite frightening. There's an advertisement of one movie there. I don't know what the movie is, but this guy is like, he's inviting this lady out to a Bible study, and he's really geeky looking, and he's really coming off weird. But that's how the world looks at Christians, unfortunately. But when you come to the Lord, it's different. You come to the real Creator, one who knows you and wants to make you free to be what He's intended you to be.